Here we go. Some more questions. So, see what we have this evening. Question number... No, turn them upside down this time. Question number one. Coming up. Dear Ajahn Brahm, some Mahayana texts mention auto-cremation as a way to fast purify. Is this Buddhism? Yeah, you burn your car. Is that what I mean by auto-cremation? Give it away, burn it. In the Pali text, I could not find any reference for such acting. Can you please explain on this topic? Thank you. I'm not quite sure what you mean. Whether it means you self-immolation, is that what you mean? You just pour petrol on yourself and burn yourself? Now that is not a fast way at all. That is crazy. I know that there were some Vietnamese monks who did that during the Vietnam War, and to try and bring attention to the politics in the country, but monks aren't supposed to get involved in politics. So it wasn't really a good thing to do, and it never really made much of an impression on anybody. So if you're talking about self-immolation, for political purposes, no. And that's not the fast way to purify yourself. If you purify yourself, eightfold path, keeping precepts. So no, nothing to do with Buddhism at all, any type of Buddhism. Especially right now, because this is bushfire season, so no one is allowed to immolate themselves. You're not allowed to light a fire for any purposes this time of the year. So no self-immolation until after the bushfire season is finished. What are defilements? I think you mean defilements, probably. Defilements are the things which they dirty and soil your beautiful mind. Just I mentioned this morning that when you see these beautiful lights in the mind, sometimes they are like they're dirty, like you've got a nice shirt or skirt, and it was nice and white before, and now it's got these stains on them, just like you've spilled your coffee on your shirt. That means it's defiled. And the defilements are all usually that desire, ill will, or just basically delusion. And sometimes people call it ignorance, but ignorance is something which you can overcome by going to university. It's not ignorance, it's delusion. In other words, you give something a meaning it doesn't have. And many people are deluded. In fact, everybody here is deluded. If you weren't deluded, you wouldn't need to come here. So, basically admit it. So, the nice way which is said in the text is the definition of delusion in the text is seeing things which are of their nature to be uncertain, impermanent, not solid, you take them to be solid. Things which are suffering, you take to be happiness, like sport. I used to follow a soccer team. They kept on losing. That's why I became a monk. Ending suffering. It's much more fun. Because they'd always lose eventually. And what else do you take to be? Now, this is an interesting one. Sex. Is that suffering or is that happiness? And I remember reading an article, some neuroscientists say, they can actually put these gizmos, I don't know actually how they do it, but they put the gizmos on the brain while people are having sex, and they find out what part of the brain lights up. And it was the same part which usually lights up when you're having pain. Check it out. And so sometimes, I'm being honest with you, they were really surprised that the pain receptors are what is actually lights up when you're having sex. Interesting. Now you know why your wife says she has a headache. And it makes the headache worse. But everybody says, no, it's fun. And for someone like me to come up and challenge one of the sacred cows of Western culture, that sex is fun, sex is enjoyable, sex is pleasurable. And you ask, is it? Or is it just you've been brainwashed into thinking it's pleasurable? Is it a delusion or not? And don't think, oh, I'm going to try it tonight just to see. No, you've got to keep the eight precepts. Experiment. Come and see, Ajahn Brahms keeps saying. No, no. But, you know, it's interesting to actually to check that out, to actually to question. This is what they call delusion. And things which you think are me and mine, they're not yours. You're deluded to think that you own things. Or you're in control. And these, what else is there? Suffering, yes, that's the three delusions. Think that what's really impermanent, you say, is permanent. What's suffering, you say, is happiness. And what is not yours, you think, is mine and me. That's what defilements are. That's the core defilement. And that's really difficult to overcome. A lot of times people don't want to overcome. I remember giving a series of lectures once on the jhanas, and it was in Singapore. And this guy came up to me, a Chinaman, and said, please, Ajahn Brahm, I'm attending your lectures, but please, please don't tell me to give up sex. He was really addicted. I said, sorry, I've got to teach how the Buddha talks. Anyway, dear Ajahn, how can one overcome wanting something during meditation? Now, that's a good question. How you overcome wanting something, there's many techniques, and I'll be teaching you many of them. These techniques. One little technique is the simile of the prison. Simile of the prison, tell this every year. One of the monks was teaching in one of the jails in Perth. After teaching one session, the prisoners asked him, can you please stay here a bit longer? Because we just want to chat to you, get to know you, get to know, you know, who you are and how you are. Instead of just teaching, we want to chat to you. So he said, okay. So they gave him a cup of tea and some cheese. And then they started talking about life in a monastery. And when he told them what it's like in Bodhinyana Monastery, get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, as I said, it's optional, you can always get up earlier, but not later. And, you know, no TV, no movies, the breakfast over there is very simple. And, you know, what the meal, just everything in a one bowl. Very often, about 3 or 4 months ago, strawberry ice cream on my curry. No, it was spaghetti bolognese. Strawberry ice cream or spaghetti bolognese. Try it. You haven't lived until you've had strawberry. Put it on your bucket list, one thing to do before you die. Strawberry ice cream on spaghetti. So, and then we just meditate all afternoon, evening time, no sort of playing around, no table tennis or football. It's actually quite austere. Remember years ago, we had some people come along, they were going to a conference, and part of the conference, after the conference, is a spirituality conference. They went to New Norcia Monastery, and afterwards they came to Bodhinyana Monastery, just to compare the two. And they all agreed, if they want to become monks, they want to go to New Norcia, not Bodhinyana Monastery, because there you get 3 good meals a day, you get wine with your meals, and you know your beds are much more comfortable, you know, in the Benedictine monastery, the Catholic monastery. And they said, no, Bodhinyana Monastery is too ascetic. And it is ascetic. And it's much more austere than in any prison in Australia. In prisons you get 3, maybe 4 meals a day if you really want to. And you have this huge choice. They told me what you get for breakfast. What you get for breakfast, you have bacon and eggs, you have pancakes, you can have waffles, you can have fruit. What else could you have? I don't know, but you know, all the cereals in the world. You can have whatever you want. It's a huge smorgasbord in prison. And that's only for breakfast. Lunch and dinner are the same. And you can watch TV, you can play tennis, you can push up weights and become fit, you can do all these courses. And you can do whatever you like, and even have movie nights over there, and people come and play guitar for you. And they say, if you want to go on a retreat, all you need to do is to punch a prison officer, you get solitary confinement. It's much better than Bodhinyana Monastery. And because the difference was so great, one of the prisoners forgot where they were, and they told this monk who they liked. They say, "That's terrible in your monastery. Why don't you come in here and stay with us instead?" He was invited to stay in prison. And it was a good reason to, because it is, honestly, far more comfortable being in jail than staying in Bodhinyana Monastery. It is. So why is it there is a waiting list, I think it's about 15 or 16 now, of people trying to get into Bodhinyana Monastery? And there's a waiting list of people trying to get out of jail, even though jail is more comfortable. Why? And it is because the people who stay at Bodhinyana Monastery want to be there. In jail, they want to be somewhere else. And that is the meaning of prison. A prison is any place or any situation where you don't want to be. And you want to be somewhere else. You have made a prison for yourself. These days, because I travel all over the place and go to conferences, and I'm quite a well-known monk, sometimes people put me up in these hotels. Fancy hotels. And nice, comfortable rooms. And I went once to this conference in Japan, and they put me up in this incredible room. They had this huge plasma screen TVs, about three or four of them, one in each suite of rooms, and I couldn't use any of them against my rules. And I had a big spa bath, and I couldn't use that either. I was afraid of pressing any button. I didn't know what was going on. I never used a spa bath before. I'm a simple monk. What else? They had a mini bar. That was, you know, off limits. And this huge bed, which I couldn't sleep on. And I was just really fed up being in there. All this stuff. I just wanted to go out and have a walk somewhere. I said, no, I had to stay inside to wait to be picked up to go to some other function later on that evening. And so, to me, that was a prison. And I thought, how strange it is that I was in this hotel room, which was at least 5-star. It could have been 6-star. I don't know. It was a really fancy hotel. I don't know. I was in a 5-star or 6-star hotel room, and it was a prison for me because I didn't want to be there. And that you can do that. Any place you don't want to be is a prison for you. So how do you become free? How do you overcome wanting something? To realize if you want something, you have made a prison for yourself. It means you don't want to be here. You want something else. You're in jail. So it's very easy to escape from jail. You don't need to climb over walls. You need to change attitude and want to be there. If I was put in prison, it would not be a jail for me. I think, yes, I don't have to teach anymore. I don't have to keep going to this damn airport and checking in and going on all these flights all over the world. And I can just sit down and have, you know, a nice breakfast in the morning, have, you know, big choice of food for lunch, much more than, you know, get a Bodhinyana Monastery. That's pretty big, but in prison it's much more. And I can actually sleep on nice soft beds. It'd be wonderful. I don't have any responsibilities or duties. So I'd be so happy to go to jail if it really happened. The reason why is because I'd be happy to be there. It would not be a prison for me. Any place you don't want to be is a prison. Changing attitude, want to be here, and you are free. So, when you are meditating, ask yourself, do I want to be here, or do I want to be somewhere else? You may be sleepy. Do you want to be sleepy, or do you want to be somewhere else? If you want to be somewhere else, you just made another prison, another place of suffering for you. Sometimes it's amazing, some people have got beautiful nimitta come. That's not good enough, I want jhanas. Come on. Most people will give an arm and a leg to get a nimitta like that. Just say, oh, this is good enough for me. I'm just happy to be here with this beautiful nimitta. I don't want jhanas. I'm happy to be here. And then you are free. And then all the jhanas come. So throughout the meditation, if you want something more, if you want to be somewhere else, You are in prison. You are not free. There's no way that you can get anywhere in your meditation. You've locked yourself up in the prison of wanting. So once you understand what wanting does, that is the main enemy of meditation. When you notice that, it's not just trying to watch the breath, and you're successful if you can watch the breath. You are successful if you can sit there not wanting anything. That is what we're supposed to do. That is the defilement we're supposed to be abandoning. So once you understand what it is, then you realize that is the main part of this meditation. To not to buy in to the promises that wanting gives you. Wanting promises you, you follow me and I'll get you whatever you want. And it's very sneaky and it's unfaithful and it never provides the goods. Wanting promises you everything and it only delivers you suffering, disappointment and frustration. So see what the enemy is and then it's easy to overcome wanting. That's the heart of meditation, letting go of wanting. Here we go. Dear Ajahn, no question, just my feedback. Excellent teacher, excellent spiritual crew, excellent management, excellent place, excellent facilities, excellent accommodation, excellent food, excellent teddy bears. Well, I did, but I added that. You know we've got another one now? So to have gender equality, we've got a female one now. Sada. We'll apply for permanent stay eventually. Nothing is permanent. Just apply to disappear. Dear Ajahn, at times when I dream, I am aware that I am dreaming. And please comment. When you are dreaming, you are aware that you are dreaming. Please comment. Are you really dreaming? Are you asleep when you're dreaming? Or are you dreaming that you are now awake? Which one is it? Are you really awake now? Or is this a dream? How can you be sure that this is really happening? And this is not a dream in a moment you just wake up. What's the difference between dreaming and being awake? Who can answer me? Anyway, it doesn't matter. You can be aware you are dreaming, but it's not full awareness. Which is one of the reasons why, yeah, you can get what was called lucid dreaming. But then it's not really much fun because you're not that lucid. You're not as lucid as you are now. And one way you can find out where you're dreaming or whether you are awake is when you get into the deep meditations. Because if you get to places like nimittas, nimittas cannot exist while you're dreaming. If you get a nimitta while you are dreaming, you will wake up. Because that's happened to me a couple of times. You know, you get a nimitta when you're lying in bed, have this, okay, I tell you, I was having a dream of going to visit the shrines of all these great monks. And that monk, did I tell you about him? You know, this Ajahn Tate, one of my favorite monks. I went to his shrine and I just saw this little sparkle on his shrine. That turned into this incredible nimitta. Now, when I was, you know, asleep, it was a dream. And as soon as that nimitta, wow, I was fully awake. Sat up in my bed, no way I'm going to go to sleep again now, and just carried on meditating. Because that's how powerful those nimittas are. You know, it's just middle of the night, it's midnight or something, 1 o'clock. As soon as I had that dream, that was full awake. You know, and I realized you're not going to go to sleep now after something like that. But anyway, you didn't need to, you're having good fun. So the nimittas, the deep meditations, if you do have one of those when you're asleep, you'll wake up. No possibility. It's just too powerful energy. Anyway, dear Ajahn Brahm, was chanting being practiced in the time of the Buddha? No. The only chanting they did was to actually rehearse, you know, some of the sutras, because they didn't have internet in the time of the Buddha, so you couldn't get them online. Nor could you actually get them in books. So all of those teachings, monks and nuns would remember them, and they'd meet together and they'd chant them together. And so when they chanted together, sometimes, you know, you pick up a mistake, which people make quite naturally. They say, no, you know, you've got the ending wrong. And so they would correct each other. So that's why we call it rehearsing. And so it was just rehearsing the chants. And because they would do that from the beginning, now it's become a ritual to do pyrrhic chanting or to do this other type of chanting. And this is what the Buddha said about chanting. Sometimes people don't like me saying this, but this is what the Buddha said. He said, imagine that you took a clay pot full of oil and you broke it over a pond of water, and the oil would float to the surface and the broken bits of pottery would fall to the bottom of the pond. And suppose a monk came along and started chanting, oh, may the broken bits of pottery rise to the surface, may the oil fall to the bottom of the lake. Would he be able to succeed? And the Buddha said, no, he won't, because the oil is lighter than water and floats to the top. The clay is hot, is heavier, it goes to the bottom. And he said, just the same way that some people, when you got an uncle or aunt or grandma dies, and you chant, oh, may they go to heaven. Oh, well, actually, don't chant the other way around. Oh, may they go to hell. That'd be very interesting, wouldn't it, if you can get reverse chanting. You know, you don't like somebody, and can you get these, you know, monks, you know, probably have to pay them a lot of money. Can you chant in reverse, not to actually to raise them up, because, you know, you don't like them, can you just send them down below somewhere? It'd be interesting, wouldn't it? Interesting concept. You never do that. You always want to raise people up. He said, it doesn't work, said the Buddha. But, you know, for years we try and teach people that, but they don't agree. They always want you to go to their funeral ceremonies. Does it work? It does work for the people who are living. You know, it gives them a bit of reassurance. So a lot of time, you know, the dead person goes according to their karma. Not much you can do for them. You know, except if they're around and they're listening to what's going on, you can teach them a bit of something and just maybe encourage them. But all the chanting in the world, the Buddha said, will not raise a person who's done bad karma. And if they've already done good karma, you don't need to do any chanting for them. Why do you need it? They've done their good karma. So why do we have all these rituals? And the worst of them is, you know, house blessings. What do you want a house blessing for? People we can bless, not a house. But the very, very worst, I mean, the Thais do some really weird things, but the worst is your Sri Lankan pyrrhic chanting. It is. And I don't mind saying that, because, you know, I'm very well known in Sri Lanka, so I can actually get away with this. Sri Lankan monks, you know, they won't get away with it at all. They get really blasted by people. The all-night pyrrhic chanting. They only do 3 suttas, and they take, you know, about 9-10 hours to do. And I've only tried that once. It was actually in the BSV, you know, in Melbourne. I couldn't believe what they were doing. You know, it was really hard for me to stop bursting out laughing during this important ceremony. Because, you know, this is exactly what happened. You know Namo Tassa. Now you've chanted it. We chanted Namo Tassa Bhagavato. This is how they do it. And you've probably heard this. You feel like this. It goes on. Every syllable is extended so long to make this thing go on all night. And, you know, you guys think that's really good karma, doing things like that. It's not. It's just an old ritual, you know, which is, don't know where it's come from, but it's not original to Buddhism, and it is actually distorting the beautiful teachings of Buddhism. But will you do it? So it's tradition, we'll do it. So come on, and there's some traditions you should say no to. Otherwise Buddhism gets loaded with these rituals from the past and it gets destroyed. Young people think, what the heck's going on? And that's a good question. Anyway, what is the significance of chanting? It can inspire you. For me, I know Pali, I know what these chants mean. And so when I chant, some of these are really, really, really inspiring. The Ratana Sutra was one of my favorites. It tells you all the qualities of a stream winner. So when I chant that, it's brilliant, it's so beautiful. Such as Kinang Puranan Nawang Nati Sambawang Virata Chitai Tikepa Wasaning Te Kina Bija Awiwulhi Chanda Nibanti Dira Yatayang Padipo. You know, sometimes people, you know, they get surprised that I can chant, and I know Pali, they think I just make these things up, I just tell jokes. But you know, I know my stuff as well. And so, what that means, that you know, those who have destroyed the sea, taking the beach, Awiwulhi Chanda, the Chanda, this desire, won't grow anymore. It's, you know, been stunted, it's destroyed, Awiwulhi Chanda, destroyed. We've chanted Nibanti Dira. They are going to cease. Just like this land, this flame will Nibbana. This is one place where you see what the meaning of Nibbana is. It's exactly the same word when a flame is extinguished. So that's what Nibbana means. Something extinguished. And when I read that, or chant that, it's incredible, powerful, deep Dhamma, telling you exactly what Nibbana is and just what a stream winner is. They've destroyed the seed. There's no more existence for them. That's it, finished. Very, very clear. I know that some people say Nibbana is this and Nibbana is that, but there's a chant where you're hearing how the Buddha described it, and it's really inspiring. It always reminds you what to do. So that is, you know, the chanting, when you know what it means, then it's great. But I have been telling some people that there is an advantage sometimes when you guys don't know Pali, because then I can get away with making mistakes, which I did recently. I was doing a wedding ceremony, and I was doing the chanting for the wedding ceremony, and I was tired, and I did the funeral chanting by mistake at a wedding ceremony. No one noticed. They said, oh, nice chanting, Ajahn Brahm. They didn't know it was funeral chanting. And the strange thing is, they're still together. didn't change anything at all. So I got away with that because people didn't know what I was chanting. Why is noble silence necessary during retreat? What is its significance? If you can keep this closed and quiet, you've got a good chance of stopping the inner speech. Now, all these thoughts which go on in the mind. If you speak a lot, that encourages the inner speech. So by having noble silence when you hardly speak at all with your mouth, that actually restrains the inner speech called thinking. And this one should be very easy to restrain. If you can't restrain the speech, you'll have no chance at all restraining your thinking. So we start with this, and then we go on to the higher restraint of not saying anything, not thinking so much. You don't need to give a commentary on your life, you know, what's happening. That's what people, apparently they do all these tweets. You know, I'm in the bathroom having a pee, and they have another pee. Yeah, I'm in the monastery, you know, listening to Ajahn Brahm. And I'm, this is, apparently it's just absolutely inane sort of stuff which they put on these tweets, just telling people where they are and what they're doing. And that just shows just this whole movement of the mind called the inner commentary. And this is actually where you tell other people, and most of the time you're telling yourself. Tweeting to yourself in your brain what you're up to. You don't need to do that. You know what you're doing. Just be aware, be silent, and see if you can calm down the inner commentary. So noble silence helps. Hi Master, please speak a little bit about Sangwega and also about Sati Sampajanya Atapa. Oh my goodness. Sangwega is when you really get to understand the mess you've got into. Being born. If you think that, you know, your body is getting a bit old and aching, it's going to get much worse. It's all downhill, you know, from here. And you know what happens when you get over the hill? The further you get down the slope, the more you pick up speed. It's true. So you're all getting old. After about, was it 23, 24, you start losing brain cells. You don't make any more. So you're getting stupider by the day. Me too. You're falling apart. You know that. Your teeth are starting to go. Despite the dentist, they're rotting. Your skin is rotting. Your hair is falling out. Even though you dye it, it's falling out. And you know what it's like when you get old. Your legs get weak. Your arms start to shake. You can't hear very clearly. And even your eyes, you need glasses to see. You know, you start to fall apart. But there's one thing I've noticed with old people. One part of them which gets stronger every year. That is their mouth. Old people, they can't hear, they can't see, but my goodness, they can talk. They get stronger with age. And there's a few old people here who could actually prove it. So same way, what have we got into getting born? So we have this sense of, this is not a good thing to do. So we see if we can get out of getting reborn again. Sati, mindfulness, sampajanya, wisdom, atapa, it's almost like it's a dedication to actually doing something about the problem. Ajahn, in the morning you mentioned that people with good virtue would have an easier time meditating and reaching high stages. What about people who have a difficult time meditating? Does that mean our citta is tainted and not as good? Quite likely. I'm being honest. You know, because you know what it is? People always want to be good. They think they want to be good. But, you know, be honest with yourself. Can you be better? Can you be kinder? Can you be more generous? Can you be more forgiving? Can you? Of course you can. So, you know, try that. But a lot of times when people come to meditation retreats, the meditation is not so good, then they ask, can you give me some trick? You know, so I can, you know, overcome all these problems. Yeah, I can give you those tricks. But some of the best ways of meditating, you know, people say, well, my meditation is no good. How are you living your life? What are you doing? You know, are you keeping precepts? Are you being kind? Are you being selfish? You know, how do you spend your day? Are you negative and angry at people? Do you feel guilty to yourself? You know, try and look at those ones and your meditation can take off then. But anyway, there's other tricks as well, so you don't have to be too depressed. Again, I'm a lawyer. I can get you out of these difficult sentences. Well, it's stuffy bit. But anyway, I've been meditating following instructions but seem to be going round in circles. I've been practicing for about 2 years. Only 2 years? That's nothing. You're just starting. Look, this is so many lifetimes, you know, you've been being a human being. 2 years, that's just a snap of a finger. So don't worry about 2 years. When it's 20 years and you say I've been going round and round, fair enough. But you just carry on practicing, you get there in the end. Stop being so impatient. It took Anuruddha, one of the great disciples of the Buddha, 17 years before he became a stream winner. And he had the Buddha as his teacher. Ananda, he didn't become enlightened until after the Buddha passed away. He was with the Buddha for a long time. And you guys, 2 years and you want to get enlightened? Come on. So, but you learn little by little and you do grow. Sometimes though, it's just like I remember planting these jackfruit trees in the monastery in Thailand. And it was in a field which had hardly any goodness in it at all. Actually, the farmer gave it to us because he couldn't plant anything. We planted those jackfruit there. We looked after them. And it took about 8 or 9 years. And then suddenly, it started to take off. And once it started to take off, it grew really quickly. And I think that's just like meditation as well. Sometimes it takes a long time just to get the foundations right. And then when it starts to take off, it really takes off fast.
and you don't know when that time is. So you've got no choice, you might as well just carry on and see what happens. What do you mean by interview, issue of Dharma or any personal stuff, etc.? This is when we have the interviews in the morning. Please don't do personal stuff, because personal stuff is endless. And now look, why are you asking me questions about marriage? I've never been married. What about questions, you know, about your job? I've never had it. Oh, I did have a job for 1 year, but it's such a long time ago, I forgot. So what other questions do you ask about your family? I haven't got any kids. Oh, it's such a boon not having kids. If you want, you know, if you want someone to share your life with, get a dog. Dogs are much cheaper than kids, and they're always happy to see you, and they don't ask for anything. And their kids, when they're 30 and 14, you just, you know, they just want a doorway into your wallet, that's all. So, dogs are great, they're nice companions, easy to look after. You can go away for, you know, 3 or 4 weeks overseas and put the dog in the kennels, and the dog's very happy. Try that with your kids, putting the kids in the kennels for 3 or 4 weeks. No kennels will take them. But no, some of you have got kids, and so they're very sweet, but, you know, but, well, you know what I think. So anyway, so in the interviews, try on meditation or Dhamma, but not too much on the personal stuff. Because also, you've only got 10 minutes, and you can't really sort of give answers to personal stuff, you know, in 10 minutes. So anyway, that's the interview. It's supposed to be about meditation. Dear staff, hey, is it possible to do well-being meditation outside? A walking meditation outside? Yes, of course. You can do walking meditation any place in this compound. Is it possible to stand up in the meditation room? I mean, like sit 1 hour, stand up 50 minutes and sit 1 hour again. Yeah, you can do that. But standing up is quite painful. So, you know, if you're doing standing meditation, be very careful. Don't stand for too long. Because you know, otherwise, you know, it does make your legs ache. But if you want to try that, fine. Give it a try, see what happens, and you can stand up in this room. Dear Ajahn, I've been having such a very nice time just washing my breath. Thank you so much, lots of metta. See, it works. Dear Ajahn, I don't care for nimitta or jhana at all. Great, I hope by sitting I can get rid of all my fear. Great, is there anything wrong by practicing this way? Great. No, that's excellent. Because those of you, this is my problem, because I talk about these things, like nimittas, brilliant bliss. If you get nimittas while you're asleep, you get so much energy, you know, you can't sleep. The jhanas, bliss better than sex, even better than that. Because this was a guy here about a year ago, he was a recovering heroin addict. And then he came to the monastery, you really feel for these guys because they were trying their very, very best, you know, to give the stuff up. Had a beautiful wife who was supporting him all the way, came and stayed here for a while, trying to get some good sort of companionship and some good advice. Unfortunately, he went back to the stuff again, which was such a shame. But before he did that, you know, he came, at Bodhinyana, he came running up the path to me one day. He said, Ajahn Brahm, I've got to tell you this. You know, when you said, now the bliss of these nimittas or jhanas are better than sex, he said, yeah, I sort of believed you, but you are wrong. It's much, much better than that. You're demeaning the bliss because it's better than heroin. He just had a really blissful experience. He said, I've never thought I could ever say this. Now the bliss of meditation is even better than heroin. Now of course I've never taken heroin. I had sex when I was a young man, so I know what that feels like, but heroin I've never taken. And so for him it was just way, way better than sex. And he was saying this meditation was way better than heroin. And that really blew him away. But when I say that, what happens? You say, wow, I want some of that myself. And the trouble is, I describe it like that so you know what you're getting into. But also, it can create a lot of desire and craving. I want one of these nimittas. I want it. I'll just taste them to see whether what this monk's on about. Now that is the biggest problem with the way I teach. It does generate desire. So I'm sorry about that. Be aware of that. Don't crave for the jhanas. Just put into place their causes, which is contentment, stillness, peace. Put the causes into place and the jhanas will come by themselves. But if you want the jhanas, you're going to have a lot of frustration. So that's why you say, I don't care for nimitta or jhana at all. Great. But I sit in and get rid of all my fear. Brilliant. That's much better. You're putting the causes into place for very peaceful, happy states of mind. See if you can overcome your fear. Anything wrong? No, that is perfect practice. Dear Ajahn, when one has never fully seen the mind, either, i.e. never been in jhana, how can one recognize happiness of the mind? Are emotions such as letting go of my way of doing things, or moments of accepting and forgiving, glimpses of this happiness, in which case nurturing these emotions will be a good guide to meditating correctly? Yes. All of these mental happinesses, you can know this has nothing to do with, like, you know, having delicious food or seeing a great movie. It's a happiness which has got nothing to do with worldly things. This is why the Buddha called it Niramisa Sukha. No, happiness nothing to do with the five senses or with the world. No, inspiration, for example. You hear a really good talk and you go, wow, that's just so inspiring. Now that is the right happiness, the happiness of the mind. You know, you see someone doing a really beautiful act of kindness and compassion. You know, that. Maybe like somebody has missed their meal because they've fallen asleep when it's supposed to be breakfast. And you just go and get something for them. You knock on the door, here, have breakfast in bed. And you don't even know them, they're just sharing your cottage. Now that is inspiring, that's the beauty of the mind. Those sorts of stuff are the happinesses which you can indulge in as much as you like. This is the stuff which makes a pure mind. Just compassion and kindness. So that is the happiness of the mind. You don't need to have jhanas to know those happinesses. They've got nothing to do with satisfying your senses. Everything else to do with kindness, with letting go, with forgiveness, with generosity, those sorts of things. And those are the kindnesses, the happiness, which are just so wonderful that so available, and people don't enjoy them as much as you should. Now even, you know, sometimes already for some of you, I've opened the door for you. Monks aren't supposed to do that. You're supposed to open the door for me, but I do it for you because it's fun. I am doing my goodness, giving simple things. Now that is where you get lots of happiness from. That's a beautiful mental happiness, of selflessness, of giving. So that's the happiness of the mind. And again, it's giving up your way of doing things because out of compassion for others. How can I help someone else? You all know what they say, that if you, there's only one banana left and you take it for yourself, you get a certain amount of happiness, but you give it to somebody else, you get many, many times the happiness back. You know, that's been proven so many times. So those are the inspirations, the joys. Now really get into it. Is it okay to listen to guided meditation on MP3 in my room? Or even in the meditation hall? Yes, you can. Or what about reading Dharma books during retreat? Yes, but not Harry Potter. Why don't you guide meditation during retreat every now and then? Is because that there's people come, there's people go, we don't have a routine, which is why that sometimes guided meditation doesn't really fit in. People have suggested that before, but it doesn't really fit into the schedule where anybody can come in at any time. Because some people would love a guided meditation, another person may be almost in jhana, and they hear my voice and it spoils everything. So that's why if you want to do guided meditations, fine, on MP3s. In your room or even in here is fine. Then those who want to can, those who don't want to aren't disturbed. So that's usually how we do it here. Dear Ajahn, how do we draw the line in business on exaggerated marketing pitch versus being honest and keeping the precepts to refrain from lying? Yeah, it's a bit difficult, isn't it, when you sort of, you know your product is not as good as the other product, but you have to sell it anyway. So you should have honesty in advertising. So, you know, if you're, say, Colgate toothpaste, you should have, honesty. Colgate toothpaste does not make your teeth as clean as McLean's, which is much better than Colgate. It'd be an interesting advertising campaign. It'd give it a little twist, and probably more people buy Colgate afterwards because they think that, advertisers never tell the truth anyway, so you must be lying, so Colgate probably is much better. Try it, see if people will believe it. You can try it in politics. Imagine if the Labour Party said, well, actually, yeah, the Liberal Party have got much better policy than us. They're a much better government than we ever were. I wonder what would happen. People would say, you lying again. That means you must be right. You must be much better. But sometimes, is it really lying? So when you market things, and the best thing to do is, if you have a product, just it must have some good in it, so focus on the good in it. And just tell the good things in it. But maybe just tell the things which it can't do. And then maybe that people will trust your honesty, and because you're an honest company, they'll say, well, at least we can trust these guys, and that honesty is a great marketing tool for a company. So maybe you can change the business model. Dear Ajahn Brahm, but anyway, I don't know anything about business. I know how to market Buddhism. And I've got all these ideas on marketing Buddhism. Now, franchising. So we franchise Bodhinyana. We've already got Bodhinyana International in Hong Kong. The franchise has started. And so we can franchise in Korea. We can franchise in, where else, in Brazil. We can franchise in Switzerland. Where else can we franchise? In Colombo. So, have a franchise. That's how KFC started. Is that a good idea, do you reckon? Bodhinyana Monastery. We meditate deeper. Is that a good slogan? Should we do that? I have often thought of, you got to adapt Buddhism to the modern lifestyle. So I have thought of, in town, to have drive-through temples. Mac Buddhas. And it's quite easy, because I've been to McDonald's when I sometimes, you're doing a funeral or something, you haven't got enough time to get food, so you go to something quickly. Apparently you go there and there's this big board of the menu. So have the menu in Mac Buddha's temple. And you've got chanting and for marriages, for examinations, for health, or for getting a partner in life, so you can press which one you want for chanting. Or you can have counselling, for marriages, bad boss at work, cancers or whatever. And what else can you do there? Oh yeah, and at the counter there, when you come there, they give you the headphones, different headphones for the different types of chanting, so you listen to that. And the person behind the counter says, do you want holy water with that? Instead of fries without holy water with that. And if you say yes, she presses the button, you get squirted with holy water. You have to go wind down your window first of all. And then you just go to the last place, and if you're Chinese, you give a red packet, the ang pao. Or, just a white packet donation, or if you're Sinhalese, a brown paper bag with another towel in it. Why do you keep giving towels to monasteries? We have so many towels from the Sri Lankans who give pirikira. Come on, can't you think of something else to give the monks? We've got whole heaps of towels. It's actually quite helpful because we had a big bushfires Stoneville. And that we had so many towels because of you guys. And apparently that's what they needed. All these people lost their homes, in the bushfires in Perth a couple of weeks ago. So we sent a whole trailer load of towels and other stuff and toothpaste. And they just really loved it. Said, thank you so much. At last, we found a place to get rid of all these towels.
Okay. So anyway, that's my idea of Mac Buddha's drive-thru.
And it'd be really popular. Because, you know, you want to get some counseling for something or some chant. You haven't got time to go to a temple and wait for the monks to get ready and do all this bowing and stuff and take your shoes off and stuff. You just keep your shoes off in your car, get the headphones, brilliant chanting, and then off you go. Shall we start one?
No, there's something wrong with that. It worked, though.
Anyway, can you please explain walking meditation? I see some people walking steady and others racing. Also, as per this morning's talk, to meditate, you disengage the five senses, which seems not possible with walking meditation, metta. Yes, there are so many different ways of doing walking meditation. But when people do the very slow walking meditation, we call that zombie training. Because apparently there's lots of movies now. Apparently they started off with, what was it, vampires. They had too many vampire movies, and so they stopped the vampire movies, and now they have the zombie movies. And so, and they get the idea from seeing Buddhists doing their walking meditation. Walking. That's what people say. They come here and they see you guys doing the slow walking. Zombies, mum, there's zombies. So you just walk naturally. It is true that sometimes you get very peaceful. You feel like walking slowly, fine. But no, don't play. Don't sort of, concoct it. If it's natural, you're walking slowly, fine. If you're walking fast, fine. So keep it natural, just what the body feels like it needs to do. And can you disengage from the five senses? You can disengage from the past and the future. So you can just be in the present moment when you're walking, just one step at a time. So you're not thinking about what you're going to do next. It's not a time for just planning your life. You know, it's just a time for keeping the mind calm and peaceful and just putting all your attention on the feelings in the feet as you're walking. I'll say more about that later on, about walking meditation. What can you do if you don't know where you belong in life? What are you talking about? You're here. This is where you belong. Wherever here happens to be, that's where you belong. So the idea of what the question here says, where will I belong in the future? And that's just going off into the future. Who knows what might happen in the future? There may not be a future. You know, there may be, as I said to a few people, one day it's going to be right, a big meteor coming to Perth. And you know that, you Koreans, you know when Kim Jong-un, he actually shot this rocket? You know, it came right over here. Over Jhana Grove. Because I was in the office over there, and Ajahn Sujata said, come over here, Ajahn Brahm, come over here. And he had this like satellite tracker on the internet, because somebody had emailed him, hey, look out, there's a rocket coming your way. And he got on the satellite, and it was a North Korean rocket, came right over Perth, and it actually came right over Bodhinyana and Jhana Grove. It obviously didn't land here, it got too much power. So it kept on going and fell in the ocean somewhere, but it came right over us. You see, it can happen. Now, when Kim Jong-un understands there's so many of you South Koreans staying here, there's quite a few of you, this is a great target. So he may send another one over tomorrow, and that's the end of us all. So we don't know where we're going to be in the future. So where do you belong? You belong in the present moment. That's the only place you'll ever have. Right here, right now. That's where you belong. If you understand that, all of this thing in life just disappears. I know what the characteristics are for a good teacher. However, how do you find a teacher, or does a teacher find you? That means you haven't found a teacher yet. So that doesn't make me a good teacher. Oh my goodness. Oh, I despair. The characteristics are for a good teacher. The teacher is not a person. The teacher is in here. That is the only teacher you ever find, you ever need. The job of a monk like me is to get rid of you. That's my job. I'm trying really hard. I'm telling all these bad jokes, and you keep coming back every year for more. I can't figure it out. You're masochist. Now, a good teacher tries to get rid of their disciples. Like at school, we want you to graduate, so you don't need to come back ever again. So I'm trying my hardest to get rid of you. And I'm not a good teacher, because, you know, many of you keep coming back. Kanchana, how many times have you been coming back here? Can't count. Just, I'm a terrible teacher, I do apologize. If I was a really good teacher, you'd come here once, become enlightened, like Baha, you're going to the Buddha, and you never need to come back again. That's if I was a good teacher. So I'm a terrible teacher. So that's why people keep coming back again and again and again and again and again. So a good teacher doesn't try and accumulate disciples, tries to teach them, empower them, so they can be independent. That's how you know a good teacher. What's the difference between emptiness and stillness? Okay. Stillness comes first, emptiness comes afterwards. Stillness is the cause for emptiness. When it's still, it vanishes. When it's vanished, it's empty. Nothing left. Gone. At last. Please could you expand on the concept of equanimity as described by the Buddha as one of the four qualities, other being loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy? No, I don't like feel like answering that question. That's called equanimity. Equanimity, I answer the question, don't answer the question, it's all the same to me. That's equanimity. Are you happy I didn't ask the question? Or are you upset I didn't answer the question? If you're upset I didn't answer the question, that's not equanimity. If you don't care, he answers the question, he doesn't answer the question, it's all the same. That's equanimity. I don't understand the simile of the loss of a person and the ending of a concert. If a concert ends, I can go to another one. If it's not a Jimi Hendrix concert, or play a record. If a person dies, there is nothing left except memories. Isn't that a difference? No! You get reborn again, they get reborn again, you have it all over again. So it's just like a concert. The concert's ended. So the music, Jimi Hendrix is dead now. But, you know, who else is dead? That's Elvis Presley is dead. Or is he dead? Or is he playing in a secret location with Jimi Hendrix? He's been sighted many times, you know. Is Elvis Presley alive in Bodhinyana Monastery? He's cut his hair off. Would you recognize Elvis Presley? Or even Jimi Hendrix, if they cut their hair off? Have a look around, maybe. See which monk has got blue suede shoes. Anyway, what am I talking about? So when a person dies, you know, so often you meet again. How many people have fallen in love at first sight? It's not at first sight. You did. Right. It's not at first sight. It's here we go again. I know this girl. Seen her before somewhere. You know, in a previous life. It's just, you know, almost like a deja vu. Here we go again. Unfinished business. So, you know, the concert finishes, but you have another concert in your next life. It goes on and 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 on. So that's what happens. Is it correct that the human realm is the fifth from the bottom of the 13 realms? If so, please elaborate on the other realms in order. Yeah, we're very close to the bottom. We're plumbing depths and we can go a little bit lower if we really want to. Yeah, it is a low realm, but they say, and there's a good reason for this, you know, we have really sort of painful bodies. And they'll be true about it.
many of you, even if you're healthy, you know, you always get sick, it aches, you know, you have to, you know, rest it at night time because otherwise it's not good. You know, you always have trouble with, have to put food in your mouth every day, 3 times a day, and as soon as it goes in, you have to go to the toilet afterwards. You know, it's, imagine that you could just eat and you never had to go to the toilet. And you could eat whatever you like and you never get fat. You just eat for pleasure. And it has no consequences afterwards. You just eat and have fun. And there's no sort of having to go to the toilet, no burps, no farts, nothing. Wouldn't that be amazing? But you know, when you eat, you have a little bit of pleasure, you have all these problems afterwards. And you know, you have to work so hard to get all of this food. And sometimes, you know, people run out. Or you go to a restaurant, it's never quite good enough. Almost, you know, your delicious meal, but never just like that meal you had with your mum, you know, years and years ago. And it's so disappointing, life. And even having sex, it's never just almost good enough, but no, it's not good enough. And then you have a baby, then you're in big trouble. So it is a lot of difficulties in this life. And going to work. Do you enjoy going to work? How many of you enjoy your job? Please tell your boss, and he won't need to pay you. Do you enjoy it that much that you'd do it even if you weren't paid? Really? You must be your own boss or something. But for most people, we have to go to work to make a living, to keep our family alive. And then what happens? We work till we just, you know, we retire. And when we retire, we think, now I can relax. And by that time, you're too weak to really enjoy yourself anymore. You know, it's really hard to, you know, having a party to enjoy yourself. You know, you find if you have a party, you have to go to bed at 9 o'clock because you're worn out. But when you get very old, there's so many things you just can't do and you don't want to do. And it would be much better, I thought, somebody had this really good idea of like reversing life. So you got born as an old man or an old girl. Imagine that, you went backwards in time. So when you appeared, you know, you appeared out of the coffin, time going reverse, the coffin opens up and there you are, you know, old and doddery, and you can't really remember very much, and then you can't, your hands are very weak. But you know, every day you're getting younger and stronger. And then you enjoy your retirement years, and as your retirement years, you know, you realize you soon have to go to work. You go to work as the boss, as the most important person in the company. And then you work your way down. And you know that your partner, you know, you don't know where they're from, you know they're getting younger and more beautiful every month as they get younger and younger and more hot. And you've got lots to look forward to. And then, you know, you get to, you know, your teenagers' years when you've got all this experience in life, you get, you know, 19, 18 years of age, towards the end of your life, you know, you've been with your girl, your wife, and now you have your marriage ceremony. And then you're free afterwards. And then you can go courting and dancing with however you really want to. Have lots of boyfriends and girlfriends because now you're only 16 or 15. Yeah, you have to go to school, but you can really enjoy school now because it doesn't matter if you pass your exams or not because you've already been through work and through your career. So school can be fun. And you can look forward to ending your life just playing without a care in the world as a 5-year-old or as a 4-year-old. And then you end life just as the glint in your parents' eye. And that's your death. Wouldn't it be wonderful if you went backwards through life rather than, you know, the ordinary way? You know, because now we get all the fun stuff is over. And now we've got to look forward to old age, sickness and death. And it's not, that really sucks, doesn't it? It would be better if we get the old age, sickness and death out over first. So we can go backwards and have all the fun stuff afterwards. I remember someone wrote this article, they said it much better than I did. There's a lot to be said for that. Going backwards rather than forwards in time. Anyway, I don't know where that was going to anyway, but this is the fifth from the bottom of the 13 realms, yeah. So the other realms in order,
You have the hell realms. If you don't want to know what the hell realms are like, just go outside today. And it was it hot today? That's nothing compared to the hell realms. It's much worse than that. But who goes to the hell realms? You know what they say? All the rich people who are just miserly, who don't give charity, who aren't kind to others, they're the ones who go to the hell realms. But you don't have to worry if you're rich. Because nowadays, there are so many rich people in hell, they've installed aircon. So it's quite cool down there now. And if you go to heaven, heaven used to be a very, very comfortable place, a very safe place, but not these days. You know why? There are so many of these suicide bombers, these Islamic suicide bombers in heaven now. You don't know where the next explosion's going to go off. Stepping here, bang. You know, a Muslim told me that joke. He said, no need to go to heaven anymore. There's so many suicide bombers up there, it's not a safe place anymore. Anyway, so there's many, many realms, and you know, I don't want to go through them, but interesting question. Okay, just finish off with this one. All these realms of existence. The Buddha was, I forget how many realms, I think 32 realms of existence or something. But anyway, that was in the time of the Buddha. Are those realms fixed? Or are there more realms today? And the answer is, of course, we always make new realms to get reborn into. So that was a snapshot of the realms of existence in the time of the Buddha. But we've made more heavens and more hells. In other words, you custom make the place you're going to get reborn. If you are guilty, and you still think after all these great teachings of the Buddha, that you've done something wrong and need to be punished, that you will create a realm to punish yourself. You know that you create it, you don't need to do that. No one sends you to hell. You decide to go there because you think you deserve it. That is actually accurate. And you make the hell to suit yourself. You know, there was in Borobudur, on the bottom level, some of it is all covered up by the earth now, but the bottom level was supposed to depict the hell realms. And I remember seeing this carving of a famous story of this man, and when he died, one of the bad things he did was push over his mother and injured her. He was angry at her for something. And because of that, he got the karmic reward of going to this hell realm, where he had a razor wheel. And as soon as he went, he saw this guy being tortured by a razor wheel, cutting into his head continuously. And this guy said, I've been down here something like 600 years. And I was told when this razor wheel started torturing me, in 600 years another guy would come up who pushed over his mother. That's you. And this razor wheel flew off the old tortured man's head into the new guy's head, as he began his penance. And this guy said, it was a really bad thing I did to push over my mum. It's a bad thing that anyone would treat their mother like that. May I take on not 600 years, but 3,600 years, so the next five people don't need to suffer what I'm suffering now. And with that one thought of compassion and kindness for others, that razor wheel exploded and he got reborn up into heaven. Well, that was like an old story. Now that gives you an idea what these hell realms are. If you have negative thoughts, then of course you can stay in that hell realm. If you start having positive thoughts like compassion, kindness, forgiveness, generosity, you can't exist there. The hell just explodes and you go into a heaven realm. Because these states are mind-made. You need a negative mind to be in a negative place. If you have a positive mind of compassion, kindness, generosity, you can't live in such a place. Immediately it disappears and you get reborn in the heavenly realm. And the heavenly realms, you make the heavenly realms. I was always interested in in heaven. Because when I read the Quran, I found out that the Arab idea of heaven is rolling green fields and beautiful trees and nice flowing rivers. I thought, actually, that's England, where I live. And then the English idea of heaven is sand dunes and coconut trees and just... That was their idea of heaven. Now, a bit more sunny. So, no, the British idea of heaven was, you know, sort of the beach in Saudi Arabia somewhere. And it's always somebody else's place is heaven for us. We never appreciate our own place. And so, what is your heaven? If you wanted to go to heaven, what would it be? For me, the food would always be fish and chips. The music, not harp music, Jimi Hendrix. And what would it be for you? So what actually does happen in heaven? Which food do you get? What music do you get? What clothes do you wear? It's what you want. What you think is pleasure is that's the heaven which you will create. You make it. It's not made and you suddenly go there. You create heavens and you create hells according to what you think you deserve and what you think is happiness. Of course, it's not happiness, those things. After a while, you just get fed up. Jimi Hendrix, again. Can we have something else, please? So this is actually how you create these worlds. So there's not just a few worlds. There's many, many more than since the time of the Buddha, and you create your own one where you will get reborn if you want to. So that's heaven and that's hell, but this is a pretty much a good heaven. What more can you want than a nice soft bed, good food, good teachings, nothing to do? Isn't this heaven? So you're reborn. You've been reborn in the heaven realm. Congratulations. But if you have one negative thought, this place becomes hell for you. I didn't like that talk. I didn't like the food this morning. Then this place is hell. It's really up to you. Your attitude is what creates hell or what creates heaven. So please have a heavenly sleep tonight. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. Got a laugh. I didn't hear a laugh. Can you laugh? That's better. Okay, so have a good night's sleep. See you in the morning if the North Korean rocket doesn't hit us. That's a true story, it happened. Ask Ajahn Sujata. Have a nice night's sleep.